Thanks, everyone, for joining our session on global enterprise voice deployments. Alan and I have known several of you in our audience for several years now. But for those of you that we don't, welcome. And we'd be happy to share with you all whatever we've been doing at Unify Square over the last 6 years or so as it pertains to global voice deployments. We picked a few selected case studies of sorts to share some of the techniques that we think will help you address some of the issues that you're likely to run into. So just a quick overview on Unify Square. We're all about link, 100% about link. Founded ultimately with the vision of helping enterprises transform how they do business through transforming how they communicate. First base there is getting enterprises to rock solid state on link. And so we serve, what we're best known for is servicing the link needs of global voice enterprise deployments. Typical customer in that class, we're talking 100K users worldwide, something like 3 to 5 year execution timeframes. And we serve about 45 of the Fortune 500. But we serve enterprises large and small, so a total of over 200 enterprises we've worked with thus far. A couple of awards, one we're particularly proud of is last year, 2013, where Microsoft, we're the finalists for Microsoft UC Partner of the Year. We do whatever it takes to help global enterprises succeed with link. It often starts in a trusted advisor capacity. Enterprises that have just spent tens of millions of dollars on Cisco or Nortel or other infrastructure but are considering link will often approach us, help put things in perspective for them as to how best to move forward with their link roadmaps. And in an objective sense, because there are pretty large stakes at play for these enterprises. So we despite our backgrounds coming from Microsoft, we take the side of the enterprise and look at it from that perspective. But then, as soon as we've helped the enterprise figure out a roadmap, typically a 3-year or 5-year type roadmap, we roll up our sleeves and get right into implementation. All aspects of what it takes to be successful at link voice deployments, both long-term implementation aspects, how do you chunk up over 5 years, what's a realistic end state and how do you get there, but also the here and now of implementation. How do I turn on federation by December 31st, so on. Along with implementation, we help enterprises with getting their link environments to rock-solid operational state. So through a suite of products, PowerView for reporting and voice quality, PowerMon for monitoring, and PowerSat for end-user satisfaction, and a couple of other products as well, we help enterprises get their link footprint to a state where they can then take a mission-critical bet on it for the business. And that ultimately is what we set out to help enterprises accomplish, transforming their business through transforming their business processes by integrating them with link. So let's get right down to our case studies. Alan and I have chunked up about 10 of our experience domains, if you will, across Unify Square, working with customers, into a typical life cycle from planning to deployment to operations, support. So we'll just sort of follow that sequence, talk for a couple minutes about interesting aspects of each of them with global deployments. First, we'll cover global scale voice rollouts. How does an enterprise with 100,000 users plus worldwide, hundreds of sites worldwide, go about deploying voice? And what are the things to watch out for? What are the success factors that help? Let's walk through an example. A large Fortune 100 oil and gas customer we worked with, we helped them with a mission of deploying 330 sites on Link Enterprise Voice, 455 digital gateways, 520 analog gateways, getting all of that done in 24 months. So from a customer side, from a customer perspective, you got this big, big mission, getting a fairly major operation done in a finite amount of time. And the timeline's important because deploying Link points to major cost savings on OPEX and CAPEX and so on. And so the sooner the enterprise can get to that finish line, the faster. There's real dollars and real commitments at stake underlying that timeline. And so in that state, we're talking about site deployment velocities of something like 20 sites, 30 sites a month. And each site is a fairly complex operation. In a good case, we're talking about something like 7 months for cutting over one site start to end. And so if you've got 20 sites a month as the deployment target, there's hundreds of sites in motion at any given time, and a lot of complexity around it. In this example, the oil and gas example, just to take you through one site as an example of the complexity involved, it was a site in Texas that ended up taking 14 months start to finish. From initial site survey to cutover. And that 14 months spanned the whole gamut. You see a highly simplified version of the project plan up there, but right through site survey, initial high-level design, deep design, integration, procurement, cutover, that's just one track. You have the whole end user management track overlaid on top of it. A pretty complex operation. An example of the types of things to watch out for, it's one of many. In this particular site, they had a Nortel PBX that used the DMS 100 FAS, or NFAS in this case, signaling protocol. And that's a digital multiplexing system, and it has to do with how a PRI, how a channel on the PRI is associated with either just the PRI or a whole band of PRIs connected into the PBX. So in this case, the PBX was this DMS 100 NFAS protocol. But when it came time to procure the gateway, and the gateways actually showed up, they supported the DMS 100 FAS variant. And that was something that the project team realized sort of 4 months after the initial data was collected. And if you look at the protocol list, the typical supported protocols are pretty, and the print is pretty fine, but you got AT&T 4 ESS, 5 ESS, variants of DMS 100, NI2, and so on. Pretty easy to make that kind of error when you're filling things into a form on a survey, sort of handing it to someone else. And typically, there's a cast of something like 20 or 30 characters involved in orchestrating everything related to a specific site. So, rigor is extremely important in compressing that time frame down to something like a 7-month time frame and to getting it first time right. That philosophy of first time right, which we're going to talk about several times today, serves an enterprise pretty well, doing a large scale deployment at this sort of scale. And so what we did, about after the first 5 or 10 sites or so, and each enterprise is going to have its own experience with its first 5 or 10 sites, because every enterprise is different, connecting the dots between people, process, and technology. after the first 5 or 10 sites, we brought, packaged all of the work involved in deploying a site into something like 15 discrete packages, such as a site survey or a high-level site design, the configuration files needed for cutover, with each of them having a very standardized format as to inputs, outputs, and acceptance. This isn't just about the technical part, so that's very important. It's even more importantly about the process elements. How long, who signs off on a site design? How many days do they have to sign off? What exactly happens if sign off doesn't occur, and so on. So we brought that level of rigor, which really helped the enterprise scale out its site velocity up towards that 20 sites a month. And then, furthermore, we took all of that and baked that approach into software we called our global voice deployment system. And that, for instance, ensures that all of the dozens of parameters relevant to a site are captured, validated right upon entry, and essentially used to construct an all-up project visibility plan and format that's relevant to the entire set of project stakeholders on a 24/7 basis. So any questions before we turn over to Alan? All right.
Cool.
So we'll have Alan start with voice interoperability.
Great. Thanks, Anu. Just a quick introduction. My name is Alan Shen. I'm a vice president for our professional services company, our professional services division here at Unify Square. Great to see all of you in the room, and hope I can convey some of the experiences we've learned in working with some of the enterprises in our five-year history. So when I think about voice interoperability, you know, a lot of enterprises, they're coming from a foundation of IAM and presence. But as soon as you step into that world of conferencing or voice, voice interoperability is really the first major integration step you do as an enterprise. And one of the things I want to tell you, kind of a funny story. I think this might have been 4 years ago. I think I was sitting at a customer lab where we're trying to get some, I think at the time OCS and Cisco Call Manager Direct SIP integration. And so I'm sitting here configuring voice policies, and there's a Cisco engineer over here configuring a SIP trunk, and we're thinking, okay, I'm about to send a call to you. So, I place the call, and in Link you hear the deep, 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 right? And then when you're like, is it gonna ring? Is it gonna ring? And then you hear the do-do-do-do, right? And then the Cisco phone rings, and we're like, yeah! We're like Alexander Graham Bell connecting this call. So he picks up, and then we're talking, and this is great. And then after 32 seconds, doo-doom, it hangs up. Because for those of you that are laughing are the ones who know that the SIP timeout for getting a 200 is 32 seconds. We're like, I guess we're not done yet. And so the reason I tell you that story is that getting voice interoperability to work is way more than just connecting a call. Even when you can get the calls connected and you can do call transfer, there's a lot of nuances and details that go around to making this successful. One of the first things you want to do is, if you're setting yourself up to do voice interoperability, don't make it harder than it is. Don't try to do something that isn't supported. And so one of the first recommendations we always have to customers is, look on the UC OIP site, which is Microsoft's interoperability program, and see what Microsoft has, committed in terms of certified interop solutions. You often find other companies who will, have other positionings. I won't name specific ones, but Link is a very growing, a very popular system, and there's a lot of, benefit for a company to say, hey, yeah, I interop with Link. But if it's not on this OIP site, you never know what your outcome's going to be. So make sure you're taking an interop approach that actually is certified.
And this isn't just about towing the Microsoft line. There's some very real dollars in economics driving enterprises to try out new stuff. But our experience has told us that ultimately that list exists for a solid reason.
And one of the things, reasons why, is because successful interoperability is rarely a binary outcome. As I mentioned, getting the call connect is just the first of probably 10 or 20 steps. And I want to give you a few examples to just highlight the reason why interop is such a challenge, and you want to really have good expertise and set yourself up on the right foot. So one example I'll give is actually a very simple one, an APAC Power-based company, and they had an existing CS1000 PBX there. And we're going to put a gateway in place so that it can do voice calls over the link. Very, you know, straightforward example. One of the things that we just didn't, it turns out the PBX was configured so that when you make a call, it expects a ringback from the telco. It didn't do any sort of local ringback. That's just a configuration option. It's not a one's right or one's not right. But when you put the gateway in place, they would call link, and we're like, how come there's no ringback? When you answered, you just started to hear audio. And so it's a very simple thing. You end up just needing to turn on the ringback function of the gateway, and things were fine. But it's an example of like one of a nuance that just kind of escapes us sometimes. Some more complex issues that come to that we've hit in the past. I want to give you one example. There's a global financial services company that had a really interesting case. They were doing a integration with Avaya PBX, the session manager. And this is a great example because it's such a nuanced issue. If you look, there's a very specific reason I put a Wireshark trace up there. If you look really closely, you'll notice there's a sequence number jump from 13424 up to 14296. And I want to tell you what happens here. The way they had integrated it, Microsoft recommends basically anchoring your media on whatever next hop you have, whether it be a session border controller or some IP PBX. And the way they had used it was in a way that wasn't anchoring that media on there. But for certain devices on this Avaya, when you wanted to do DTMF, you weren't actually able to, the phone wasn't actually able to send DTMF. So they do this thing called shuffling, where if I'm going to send DTMF, the phone says, hey, well, I can't send DTMF directly, so then I'm going to switch the media stream over to the session manager, send to DTMF. Once that's finished, I'll then go back to my mainline stream. And that's the reason why you would see these sequence number jumps, is because it's flipping from the session manager to direct media. And what ends up happening is that in the QoE logs, it turns out that this flip will be detected as packet loss. Because from the standpoint of link, it thinks, oh, wait a minute, my sequence number just jumped by a whole bunch. What happened to those packets? It has no idea that that was actually an expected thing. So they're seeing packet loss reports, poor call quality, when real life, it's actually just this DTMF thing. So really interesting, nuanced example, right? Another example I want to talk through is this global professional services company. Again, similar principle, when you don't anchor media, they had a situation where every few calls, there was a situation where the acceptance of the call on the signaling channel sometimes came after the very first RTCP packet. And in that case, what ended up happening is the call got disconnected because that unexpected RTCP packet before the session was pinned up was, made the client think it was an error. It's a very, very hard issue to track down and debug. And it turns out as soon as they anchored the media on the SBC, that resolved the issue. So I just want to give those few examples and stories. Just make sure you avoid the resist to self-engineer a solution. When we recommend a solution, an approach, there's usually a good reason why we want to do things that may seem less optimal. It's because they're ones that are supported. Any questions on this particular interop story? Any hope I'm not losing people by talking about these details here. All right, let's go on to the next step. So you have your direct SIP connection working, you're making calls, everyone's happy. Then of course the next logical step is to say, hey, I can just add a phone number here and get a dial-in number working, right? Pretty simple, a link's quite straightforward in doing that. And if you're a small enterprise, exposing a single 1-800 dial-in number is actually not too bad. But if you're an enterprise that's coming from an existing dial-in conferencing solution, imagine you have Verizon or AT&T, and they have some 200 sets of dial-in numbers across the world, right? And so you're thinking, okay, well, if I'm going to transfer my dial-in service to my users to Link, it's probably not good enough for me to provide just one dial-in number. I need to provide a comparable level of service. So what are the different approaches for addressing that solution? And there's really two main ones. On the one spectrum, you can say, well, if I'm a global company like Microsoft. I have global presence. Maybe I have gateways in each of the different locations. Why don't I add a dial-in number at each of those locations and make that my dial-in, my set of dial-in ingress points, right? On the flip other side of the spectrum, you can say, well, I'm going to work with a service provider to provide me the access to all that dial-in, those dial-in numbers, and then trunk that to me at my data centers. And that's the other approach. And you can even take a hybrid approach if you want to. We've seen customers where they maybe have a local dial-in number, but then add a few additional ones on a regional level. Let me talk through some of the considerations of one or the other. So if you're like Microsoft and you expose all your own dial-in numbers, one thing to keep in mind is when you have a dial-in conference, there's one conference mixing entity. So for instance, let's say it's a person in Redmond that scheduled the conference, but somebody in the UK is dialing a UK number to join it. That media is going to traverse the corporate WAN. And so as soon as you do this, one of the first questions you should ask yourself is my WAN engineered to support a good audio quality experience? And for a lot of global customers, the WAN can be a big pain point. Maybe it's the QoS settings aren't consistent. Maybe bandwidth's expensive. So that's one of the very first questions you want to ask yourself. And if your WAN is not engineered well, you're probably going to set yourself up for a situation where that UK users could have some poor voice quality. And if there's any remediation you need to do, you'll factor that into the total cost, because that's an important element to consider. Another one is that the folks in the UK, there's a UK site that's expecting that, say, PRI, for their own voice calls. Now you're also mixing in dial-in service to that, right? So let's say, just hypothetically, you have a conference in the US, you have 20 people who are dialing from the UK, all of a sudden that customer only has three channels left for their own local office. Is there any sort of issues around concurrency of that PRI because it's a shared resource? So think through that consideration as well. Now, on the other side, the other side of the spectrum is, hey, let me work with a service provider to provide all these dial-in numbers. And the way that works is that if a customer dials in with a UK number, they're going to charge some per-minute access, not to mix the calls, because that's going to happen at link, but just sort of like an access charge. And that just gets passed on to you. So it's a much easier model from a from an infrastructure standpoint. You're not having to manage that WAN upgrade and that sort of thing. When those numbers come into you, one thing we strongly encourage is that telco not to have that number just be a single number that ingresses. And I'm seeing some nods out here. You want some unique identity for each of those dial-in numbers so that you can actually manage from a cost standpoint how that service is being used. So for instance, let's say the UK number, it's going to land on a certain number. In fact, some of the sub-trunking providers will also make it a SIP URI rather than an actual phone number. But that way, if you have some sort of monitoring you're doing, either say with PowerView or just with QoE reporting, you can try to track the usage of that, if necessary, have an approach that lets you do chargeback for the different divisions. So those are just a couple different approaches that you can take. One thing I want to just mention is from a cost consideration, one of the things we're seeing is a lot of the telcos are providing very aggressive pricing. And so I would say 3 years ago, the ROI and the cost justification for bringing in dial-in conferencing was very, very high. Now we're seeing the telcos are like, hey, we don't want to lose this business. We want to make it hard financially for a customer to switch. And that's true. You do need to look at that cost equation and the total impact there. But one thing to keep in mind is that there's a big user benefit to having a conferencing system that allows a mixture of voice over IP and dial-in conferencing. A lot of the existing conferencing deployments are where you maybe use WebEx for your web conferencing, and everybody has to dial in. Well, as soon as you expose the VoIP world and the dial-in world, the flexibility impact is very huge. And you now need to start considering, well, because I've exposed those two worlds and bridged them, maybe there's a subset of that dial-in conferencing that is now going to be connected over VoIP. And it's instead of having the same number of dial-in minutes as before, that's to be carried over IP. So factor in that transition into your cost savings equation as well. It's not going to be that 10 million minutes over here is going to be the same 10 million minutes over here. So just some initial thoughts on dial-in conferencing. Any Any questions on that? Yeah, Steve? Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. Stephen makes a good point here that by doing, if you take an approach of providing your own dial-in ingress points, you are responsible for uptime of those environments. So let's say your UK site goes down. You're going to have to figure out redundancy, maybe having another gateway, or is there a site failover? Things like that. Whereas if you hand that over to the service provider, you know, they, in some ways, you're paying for them to manage that. So absolutely, it's a good consideration. Yes, sir?
Doesn't some of that also obviate some of the regulatory issues you might run into in some countries with VoIP traffic? I mean, some of that VoIP traffic may still cross some line in terms of regulatory constraints and issues, but, you know, wouldn't that sort of take a little bit of that off the table?
The question was, you know, does this take away some of the regulatory issues around, for instance, like, are you thinking India, voice regulation?
That's the usual suspect.
there are other countries as well. Yeah, India's the one that usually comes to mind. It's a good question. I'm thinking sort of in my mind of what, to bring folks up to speed, there are countries like India where if you have a VoIP leg that would domestically result in you not paying for a domestic long distance charge. So for instance, Mumbai and, you know, Delhi, you do a VoIP call between the two, whereas normally you have to do a local long distance call. That's actually not allowed from a regulation standpoint. So just kind of thinking through it in my mind, to be honest, what the, you know, we where it could be a problem is if you, especially if you have like your MCU conference being hosted in India, and you have different locations, that I can see, you know, having issues. Typically, if you're conferencing services, usually the data centers tend to be located overseas, and that international lag is not a huge regulatory issue. So we see it more when you have multiple sites in India with local egresses, that being a problem. But I think it's worth a follow-up conversation on that. Yeah. All right, let me go on to the next slide here. So we talked a bit about a couple planning topics that we've seen in the past. Let's go into piloting, LRS. It's a really hot topic, link room system. One thing to know about this, and by the way, we do have a session that Kevin and I are presenting tomorrow morning on deployment best practices for LRS. Keep in mind this is a new device category. And so even before you get to the point of deciding to install this, keep in mind that this is not the same thing as a typical Polycom or Tandberg video room system. A lot of customers are coming in thinking that this is going to replace that system. It's not. It's a collaboration room system. And so I think that message is starting to sink in with a lot of our customers. But that is so important to set expectations with the customer early that this is a new device category. And as with any new device category, there are some growing pains that the industry and the ecosystem is going through. Keep in mind that the platform and vendor code are still very fresh. So we're seeing updates that Microsoft are providing, updates that the LRS vendors are providing. And I want to give a few examples of some of the things we've seen in the early adopter customers who have deployed LRS. One important thing is to keep the user expectations in mind in terms of the user experience. I think there's because it's built on the Link, you know, platform, if you will, there's some folks who are sending a message that, hey, if I know how to use Link, I know how to use LRS. But what we're finding is that the display, if you look at the console on the table there, the UI there is very, very different than the UI that you have on a Link client. And so user training is such an important aspect of LRS. In all of the projects that we're working on with LRS, we're pushing this as a top-level item. And the good thing is some of the enterprises that we're working with are starting to realize that and plan in that user adoption time. As an example, if you put this LRS system in a new conference room, we're working with a large global financial provider. They're actually planning for us to be on site for something like 7 days to do a mixture of on-site training for the users that will be in this new workspace, as well as to be there in case users hit issues when they first join meetings. One of the things about user experience is that if somebody, for instance, tries to do a whiteboard and they can't do it, if you're right there and can get them over that hump right away, you've sort of fixed the bug early, if you will. If you let that issue fester, right, they're going to talk about it to their coworkers, and, I tried that room, it really didn't work, and you start to get this negative feel of the room out into your workforce. So that user adoption is really, really important. Another thing we've seen are nuances around just small things. As an example, with one of the customers they were helping to troubleshoot, even things like the HDMI cable. The HDMI cable wasn't seated correctly, and that was causing very inconsistent display issues. Just something really, really simple like that, right? So another important thing. The LRS system is the first system, I would say, on Link that is a first-class video endpoint. And so for a lot of customers to date, video has been a bit of a checkbox feature. You have it on Link, you know it works, use it maybe once in a blue moon, but it's there kind of as a nice to have. Now with LRS, not only is the room going to be using video as a first-class modality, all the participants in the conference on the Link clients will start to be seeing an increased level of video usage because the people in the room want to see the video of the participants. So now from a bandwidth planning standpoint, from a QoS planning standpoint, video is not just a second-class modality. And, how have you planned your network for video class? Have you done the right engineering there? So that's another thing that we're really emphasizing to customers. The third bullet point here on the top is an interesting one. Much like when we had the first PBX transition, if you recall, there was this whole organizational challenge about us coming as IT folks on the Link side, talking with folks on the PBX side, right? And they're worried about there's job concerns. I don't speak their language. They speak our language. Things like this. There's sort of a similar effect that happens when you put in LRS into the video ecosystem. There's usually an existing team that manages the video room systems. There's an existing real estate team. There might be a video network operations center that provides some white glove service for getting the video started. Now we as IT are coming in here and saying, hey, this LRS system, it's a self-managed LRS system. You go there, you tap the button, it starts the meeting. This is revolution. This is a transformative user experience. So the same sort of organizational coming together is so important as you plan for this LRS deployment. Bring those teams together, make sure everyone's on the same page at a business level for that to land well. Any questions on the LRS aspect? Okay, I'm going to keep going here. Oh, yeah, go ahead. I think they are actually also coming around, and I'll give you an example. Sometimes Microsoft, their first statements don't stick. How many of you remember VoIP as you are? We got QoS, adaptive media stack. You don't need to do anything with your network, right? That was the first message, and then people deployed voice. All these audio quality issues. People realized, hey, the bucket's this big. You only put so much in the bucket, right? And so they say, oh, hey, but now that we support QoS, you really need to right-size your network, do the differential services. I think it's a similar effect here. What we're seeing at customers is that when you go in and position this as a replacement for a Polycom or Tandberg, they're like, just the video quality is not there, the experience is not there. If you go in and position as a collaboration solution, just like you're seeing up here, smaller room, video is there, but the focus is on, collaborating on content, that lands. Especially when you're working with like a Ford or that type of engineering type company.
Is that a lot of that because of the issues with interoperability with the video systems? Because I know that if you want H323, then you have to go with it to Qualcomm RMX or Red versus Scopia, and there's a lot of involvement there and manual intervention.
Good question. So the question was on interoperability. There is a fairly complex interoperability story. You're absolutely right. And when you look at interoperability, you're looking at audio, video, and content sharing. So you're absolutely right. That's a whole other equation that gets introduced. But even if people are looking at, there have even been customers who have did a wholesale. We were talking with one customer. They did a whole, as a bank, that did a wholesale replacement of their existing Polycom infrastructure and went all LRS with the intention of it being a replacement for a video, their room system. And they were not, they weren't happy enough with the video, just the video quality. And it's partially just because, this unit is not an $80,000 video room system. The camera is a great camera, shown here. But it's really intended to be a collaboration solution. So I think even as a native solution, we just have to set expectations that this is collaboration for the masses, not executive high-end rooms. Yeah.
Your view on LRS market, there are currently only two vendors.
Correct.
Do you see this ecosystem growing? Any other options, self-produced, self-made systems, toolkits?
That's a good question. So far, the question was, so far there's two vendors. You have Smart, you have the Crestron, and then I think Polycom is OEMing the Crestron. So I guess objectively what we see is, if you were to compare the two flavors, Crestron comes from a point of expertise on room control integration. So those of you who are familiar with the Crestron room system and that UI, if you have, a very strong need to make sure that you have one panel that can control your LRS as well as controlling the blinds and the lighting and the audio and everything like that, that's going to be a good solution for you. However, in terms of the device, the Crestron solution is a separate overlay panel to an existing TV that you would buy, and it has basically a USB camera. It's not as much of a sort of single-built solution, if you will. Whereas on the Smart side, they come from a point of expertise of their whiteboard. So they're in, almost have 100% penetration on the educational market, have made a lot of investments in whiteboard technology, smart board technology. So they've taken that and are taking that into the enterprise space. So they've really invested in sort of a end-to-end solution. Their device comes as a single TV or a dual TV with the touchscreen all overlaid, speakers, sort of the whole thing, integrated camera. Just our personal experience, we're seeing that solution have quite a bit of traction. So far, we haven't heard of another vendor coming into play yet. Not to say it couldn't, but so far that's the state of the market.
We do expect the category to very significantly expand and succeed over the years. It truly is a game changer. Mm-hmm. And so with that, we absolutely would expect other entrants into the field as well over time and usual market dynamics to evolve. Mm-hmm. Our advice for enterprises right now, also speaking to the earlier question you had raised here, is to try out a few units, see what scenarios that lands best for within the enterprise, what business case, what scenario works best for your enterprise, so that you're ready to take advantage as the market evolves.
And I suggest one thing in tomorrow's session that we're talking about LRS, we're going to go very deep into the not only to LRS best practice, but also the link video stack itself. So you understand how LRS fits into that that backend model. This is just a quick example showing the UI on that panel there. So another aspect, enterprise voice in high-risk environments. So there's some unique challenges that go into trying to integrate link into an environment where the expectation is that voice is a 5-9 service, or into the financial sector, where everything is very, very tightly controlled and regulated. So I want to give a couple examples of how you can take an approach that lets you succeed in those kinds of environments. One example is we're working with an Asian power company. And so they have a PBX environment that's probably, a lot of those PBXs are 20 years old, and it's a power company, so a lot of the phones are out in power stations. They don't need link out there. They're just like, hey, this phone has to be up 24/7 in case there's some emergency. And so convincing this company that integrating their telephony with Link is a good thing to do for their information workers took a lot of effort. And what I'm showing here, if you look at this diagram, one of the approaches we took is that for their existing PBX, they weren't comfortable just having us put a gateway in front of the CS1K. So one of the things we did is we said, okay, let's actually do almost a pre-pilot, if you will, where we take some of the extra PRI lines off of the CS1K and put in a gateway and set up a whole new set of DIDs, set up a separate T1 trunk out to the carrier, and test the integration, including failover to another site, in parallel to their existing production environment. This is something that typically most customers wouldn't, pay for. They would just kind of go and plan it and then put the gateway in pass and then start doing the link transformation. But for this company, this step was really, really important to convince the telco engineers that gateway is not going to totally disrupt their system. And then we had a whole battery of test cases that we ran through. We very detailed design document configuration. So this is just one example of an approach that we took. And for some of your customers, this might be worth it. Another, there's a global financial services company that wanted to, we've actually seen a couple companies where there's just the idea of having a Windows server in the perimeter network is a big deal. So if you want to do any sort of federation or remote user access, of course you need an edge server in the perimeter, right? And for a company that has never had their first Windows server in the perimeter, this is a big, big challenge. And so when we went through this effort, the actual effort of installing the edge server is actually like probably 1% compared to the effort of working through their security team, doing documentation about how all the protocols work, the threat analysis, what happens if this, what happens if that, to contain all the different holes, what are the mitigation procedures for that. But it can be done. After about, around 6 months of effort, the enterprise got one edge server in the perimeter and sent our first federated IAM. And now they're four. And now there's a handful of users who are IAMing. And I remember, I think last week, that the customer, we're working on some statements of work for some follow-on work. The customer sent an IAM and said, "Hey, Alan, just had a question." I was like, I'm just shocked because there's this bank here that's IAMing me. And I'm like, wow, this is pretty amazing. We got their first Windows server in their perimeter. So the kind of long story short is that it can be done. You just need to plan for the extra implementation phases and make sure that you have the expertise to take that whole knowledge transfer and that process through to the end. It's a long road, but it can be done. Okay, with that, I'm going to hand it back over to Sanu to talk about end user change.
Thanks, Al. So Alan's been talking about pilot risk and deployment risk. Let's now talk about an entirely different animal, end-user risk. Link-EV is a huge change for end-users. We're used to these legacy telephones. That model hasn't changed much for the last 100 years. Along comes EV, and one fine day, boom, they're in a totally different world. And it's one thing for us as technologists in the room to deal with the change. We'll tend to think as intuitive and pretty easy and so on. It's quite another thing for people working on an assembly line or people in a law firm interacting with their clients, people whose work context is not technology, to deal with the change. Moreover, the change is most pronounced for execs and their admins who have very elaborate communications protocols between them, human protocols cultivated over the last couple of decades. That is their world, and we're, with Link-EV, we're completely transforming that world. So let's walk through a couple of examples on how through a combination of the right art and the right science around user adoption, global companies are successfully tackling this disruption on the end user side. So first, a global technology company. that uses a pretty rigorous approach called NSAT to precisely track end user sentiment, not only around length, not only around cutovers and voice, but also around IT services in general. It's a very powerful methodology that brings a lot of rigor to ensuring that end users are in a successful spot. So just in terms of the basics, the way NSAT works is you send a survey, a quick survey to an end user about a specific service. The question might be, how satisfied are you with your Link Enterprise voice? One for very dissatisfied, two for somewhat dissatisfied, three for very satisfied, or somewhat satisfied, four for very satisfied. And then basically, the way you compute NSAT is you take the percentage of very satisfieds, subtract out all of the dissatisfieds, both the somewhat dissatisfieds and the very dissatisfieds, and add 100. Out pops a number between 0 and 200. You want to be at a 130 or greater. The very first voice deployment in the world that this was done at, and I won't go into details here, had an NSAT of 29. 7 years ago. So a very powerful methodology. What we see typically these days is in well-planned environments, for instance, a very finely orchestrated oil and gas type rollout I talked about earlier, you might expect 120, somewhere between 110 and 130 right off the bat. But if the enterprise hasn't given focused thought to end user training or end user sentiment, you might start off with an 80 or a 90. But one particular example, again, at the same technology company, this technology company happened to make an acquisition in the Bay Area, another technology company, surprise, surprise, and thought all was well with the acquisition. Usual acquisition integration, and just for kicks, the company had us do an NSAT survey to sort of check off its due diligence checks. Are users satisfied or not? Not particularly expecting a problem, but just to sort of complete, be formal about it. So off we went, did an NSAT survey. 2 days later, we had our number 66. That's bad enough. You want to fly someone out to the site pronto. And so we did, and talked to end users, and very quickly figured out that this is a site that was a largely Mac-based site, so end users had particular issues around using Link on their Macs. And so we helped them work through how best to use Link on a Mac, how to make it usable, and so on, and got them to a decent spot. But a great example of where a proactive intervention really helped get the end user community in a good spot. Next example, for global consumer products companies, a beauty products company headquartered in the US, they've just started commencing site cutovers. And site cutovers are a particular driver of end user sentiment. The moment a user's cut over to their new phone, in a couple of days that follow, a very important time to form first impressions for that end user. And so what this company's having us do is roll out something called Hypercare, where we send user adoption specialists to that site, usually one or two per site, who are out there for something like 2 days or 5 days after the initial cutover, so it might be a Monday to Friday type of thing, and help end users by walking the floor, they help end users succeed with their first attempts at Link Voice and sort of show them the ropes, along with a couple of other structured training events at that site for that user community. So that's really helped, along with an end user survey, or NSAT survey, the combination of that's really helped get end users to a good spot around cutovers. Third example, another global consumer products company, this one having over 100 consumer brands worldwide, decided to start with their top leaders and influencers in the organization. And that's a critical constituency. We've done this for many other customers. Just as an example, the first global technology company that I mentioned had their top 300 VPs and directors and so on go through some pretty hands-on, white glove type user adoption onboarding, where an adoption specialist goes out and works with a cluster of bosses or execs and their admins. So these clusters are pretty intertwined. So you might have 10 execs share a pool of 4 admins, for example, that becomes a cluster of 14 that all need to go through this process sort of at the same time. So through doing that, admins in particular can get very familiar very quickly with the new ways of doing work, the new ways of communicating, transferring calls to their execs, setting up conference calls, and so on. But in the context of the workflows that they need to do their work, each cluster is different, each pairing is different. These communications protocols that I'm talking about, the adoption specialists can really help them work through how do they do the same workflows in the new world of Link EV.
I should mention that Carrie Dick leads our adoption practice, and she's actually in the back of the room. Did you want to stand up, Carrie? If you have any deeper questions, she is a super duper expert on user adoption. Carrie, sorry to make you stand.
No, as you all know, as an assistant to the world, more companies, right? And if we don't get it right with them, we pretty much lose more. So, especially at the executive C levels, and that's why this particular customer decided to go first, the 30 C levels, because they thought that would drive top down change. The executives are the easy part, as you guys know. It's the people that support them that handle the high volume calls. Highly critical business critical type calls at that level. And that's why we make time for them to make sure that everybody's in a good place before we peel off and go back to our day job. We want them to feel like this is fitting the way they work, they're comfortable with it. And we know that first week is so important. If we can get that first week right, and we've learned this from doing this for the last 7-8 years now. That first week, if we can emphasize something else, that is where
Yeah, so if you have any questions, she can go into more details about the types of offerings that we can do, trainings, things like that. Feel free to talk with her afterward.
Yeah. So we've talked about pilots, deployment, adoption. Now we get operational. When the enterprise is fully deployed, say on Link conferencing or even on Link voice, the enterprise at that point in time is most concerned about how do we make this run rock solid? How do we make Link run like a mission critical service? And topmost on that list of concerns and list of focus areas is service availability. Now, enterprises have built elaborate infrastructure around monitoring over the years. There's COM, there's other event gateway monitoring systems, for example, other server monitoring infrastructure and processes. But what's particularly helpful for Link is the end user view on things. What is availability of the Link voice service as end users see them? For instance, in a professional services company environment, it's pretty typical for 80% of consumer or customer employees to be outside the firewall, to be remote at any given point in time. Some companies are moving forward with the vision of having 100% of their employee base remote, all outside the firewall. So that end user view becomes exceedingly important. And what we find by rigorously measuring the end user view on service availability through a product we have called PowerMon. It's a cloud-based monitoring product that makes global synthetic transactions across every pool and possibly every office, every site across a company worldwide. What we find is that from an end user perspective, even though servers might be operating at 3 nines or even 4 nines, from an end user perspective, a typical number is around 297 right now. For a well-run environment that's in the deployment phase, in a large global setting. Now, there's a large range there. Some companies in a starting state are as low as 98%. The very best environments have gone up to 3 nines. And beyond 3 nines, you're pushing underlying stacking infrastructure like the network and DNS and related services and so on. But that's what we find in practice. We have found that through proactive focus on that number, the enterprise can over time work its way pretty significantly to a higher, much higher degree of health on end user service availability. As one example, for a global technology company that deployed PowerMon, they noticed, really a few weeks after deploying PowerMon, that there were a large number of failures coming through from Asia Pacific. In particular, gateways in Singapore were returning a 503 error at a pretty high rate. Now, end users weren't calling help desk. There's not a single instance of a help end user having had an issue there. Nevertheless, the system was reporting that a certain fraction, appreciable fraction of tests was failing. So we looked into that, looked into the underlying cause, and narrowed it down to the gateway that had a 5-second hard limit coded in a timer that negotiates signaling with the PRI out in Singapore at the other end. Because of that hard limit, some small fraction of calls was failing. And so we contacted the gateway vendor with that evidence of failure, with that pattern. And sure enough, a couple weeks later, they came out with a patch that relaxed the hard coding, made that timing interval configurable, deployed that patch. And within weeks, we could see a massive difference. The issue had practically gone away. So that's a great example of how, through proactive intervention, proactive monitoring of end-user service availability around the world, an enterprise can get work its way to a healthier state. A couple elements of that approach, it's about end-to-end monitoring. This isn't just about servers, this isn't just about gateways. Yes, all of those elements already exist in the enterprise and are necessary, but this complements that with a complete end-user view on enterprise voice. It's also based on relative user impact. If that small satellite office in Vail, Colorado, with 5 users fails, it's very different in terms of its impact and number than if the main pool in Houston fails, servicing 30,000 users. And so the approach also weights failures based on the end user population that impacts, come up with that end user impact. Second, it's pretty important to differentiate between major incidents and sustained incidents/improvements. The two are entirely different classes. Both are critically, the first is critically important. The second is a long-term optimization opportunity. Major incidents, it's important to literally shave seconds off of both detection times and resolution times. And on the sustained improvements, like the example I talked through, that sort of takes a different workflow, different time scales, yet pretty important to driving system health. So any questions on service availability? No, no. As an outside,
Can I repeat the question?
Sure.
Yeah, just go. Maybe you can repeat the question.
The question is, can we differentiate between major incidents and service of, and sustained improvements, particularly with respect to taking out major incidents from the computation or taking out downtime? So we've found that it's very useful to have an all-up objective view without any sort of correction or allowance applied, and an objective view on the overall service availability from the outside, because that then allows the enterprise to benchmark itself, allows us to help the enterprise benchmark itself relative to other enterprises. Now, when reporting up the chain, reporting up in CIO reviews and so on, there's good reason to sometimes take out planned downtime. And yes, we're absolutely working towards being able to do that so that you have different views on service availability for different contexts.
And maybe I can add to as well, if you're thinking about a major incident, which is like an unplanned outage that impacts things kind of vertically, one of the things we do in the transaction is when we do basically a test case and there's a failure, really there's kind of two buckets of failures. The intermittent failures, like the one Sanu talked about for the Singapore issues, and then a true outage. So one of the things we do is when we do our transaction and it fails, we actually retry that transaction immediately after. And basically, if that transaction then succeeds, it's kind of categorized as an intermittent failure, kind of a yellow failure, you can think about it, right? Those are tricky. Those are hard to repro, hard to debug. But if that retry also fails, we say, hey, looks like you're redlined here. Send up an alert. There's probably something that has to get looked at right away. So in that regard, we do categorize those two things differently from a system standpoint. Well, maybe I could just give a picture of the how exposed it was. So at this particular Singapore site, I think they did something like around 30,000 calls a month, and we were seeing a failure rate in and one of the things we did, they correlated via our business analytics tool, PowerView, that they do 30,000 calls a month. PowerMon was telling us it was about a 1% failure rate for those synthetic transaction calls. So the effective user impact was, you know, there were probably 30,000 of the 3,000, something like 1% of those 30,000 calls, where you tried to make a call and it just failed. And they retried, that probably call probably goes through, right? And, you know, they had syslog turned on the gateway, but the thing is, I mean, this is a massive syslog, right? And so to get to the point where you can discern what that error was, what was not viable at that syslog point. It wasn't until PowerMon even discovered that this small percentage was happening, they even thought to go to look at this log. So it's more of a detection, and then we went and then looked at the logs, and that's how we found it. Sure.
So we'll move on to the other big pillar of operational health, voice quality. In there, there's a whole slew of factors that drive voice quality. And by the way, a typical or one KPI that we use in our three KPI approach is poor call percentage alongside service availability and NSAP. So what we find in a typical global scale enterprise is a poor call percentage running something like 4%. It's 4% of all link calls that are identified by link as poor from a voice quality standpoint. Now, when we drill down into the into the makeup of that 4%, what we find is that almost always the majority of that 4%, typically 2.5%, 3%, are actually user-generated issues. So user-generated issues such as a user being on a poor Wi-Fi link or a poor device or happen to be dialing in over a VPN, et cetera, et cetera. About 1% or less of those issues are the issues you would normally associate with poor voice quality, like network issues, server issues, QoS issues, and so on. So we find that holistic view to be pretty important for the enterprise to track and manage over time. With our business intelligence and reporting product, PowerView, we do a pretty holistic analysis of voice quality for an enterprise in a way that allows the enterprise to act on this data and over time get its voice quality to a healthy state. So just to give you some snippets here, we calculate the all-up poor call percentage and then distill that down into likely root causes. So user-generated poor calls, corpnet-generated poor calls, so poor calls likely because of infrastructure issues. And then there's some externalities that the enterprise can do little about. So, like if you're on a federated call and the federated party is a poor network, the enterprise has no control over that. So that gives enterprises the holistic view. Let me turn over to Alan to talk about a view that's particularly powerful on the infrastructure side.
So I'm just curious, how many of you went to Yen's session on CQM? Anybody see that? It's very interesting. A lot of enterprises are thinking, I need to deploy a bunch of probes on the network to try to figure out different network segments that might be problematic. One of the things about QoE is that, as we know, it's an end-to-end solution, right? But one of the things that we're all kind of working toward is an approach where if you take certain segments of calls and isolate characteristics, you can actually get actionable data even though you don't have the probes going over, probes running everywhere. I want to give a couple of examples. So if you look down here at the lower right, sorry to keep pushing up. So just this is an example. We're actually building the CQM approach into PowerView. If you look here, this is our Bellevue site. We just moved into a new office. And there are some synthetic calls in here. This is why the number is so high. But you can see our wired-to-wired ratio. So people within Bellevue that are calling each other using a wired connection. That, in theory, should validate sort of the switching backbone. We're not involving any WAN traffic, not involving any wireless. We see a very low poor call percentage, 0.09%, which is kind of what you would expect to see when you're in that contained environment. Now let's introduce users still located in that site, but introduce Wi-Fi. So again, we're isolating away any WAN issues, any MCU issues, just point-to-point calls, adding wireless LAN as a factor, 13.3%. Now, imagine expanding this out to a large enterprise that has something like 130 sites. There's a single grid there where you can see probably a list of maybe 10 or 20 sites that are red for Wi-Fi. You can then tell the infrastructure people, hey, look, I think I have a Wi-Fi issue on these 20 sites. Super, super actionable, very, very powerful. That sort of model can be extended as you look at traffic from, say, the site to the MCU, so data center traffic. Is there WAN issues? Are there intra-site issues with that WAN? It's a really powerful approach. And the reason why it's important that we're putting in PowerView, I was talking with Jens yesterday, because what they're providing in CQM is a set of SQL queries and I think an Excel sheet that lets you see a view. And that's going to work fine for an enterprise that's maybe, say, 1,000 users. I asked Jens, how does this scale? So he says when he runs this against the MSIT data, the query takes 30 minutes to return. Now, with PowerView, the PowerView actually is built on what's called a cube. You can think about it as a data warehouse. So we take the core QoE data and then build another database that summarizes all the different metrics and measures and dimensions that you'd want to use for analytics purposes. And this whole site CQM approach is what we're building into PowerView. this report across, you know, millions of Microsoft calls, we can pull up in seconds. So that's the power of you know, when you want to get to a point of scalability, that CKM approach paired with the PowerView cube is super, super powerful. So I'll turn it back over to Sanu.
Yeah. Great. And on the user side, one technology we're experimenting with right now that we're pretty hopeful about is user feedback loops to drive end user behavior. So through automated means over IAM notifications, getting that end user triggered poor call percentage down as well. So we think through a combination of these approaches, a global scale enterprise, there's a pretty good chance of getting towards that 1% type holy grail number over time. It isn't going to happen overnight. You're likely talking a year, 18 months. Through a pretty structured, deliberate program to drive voice quality up. So lastly, in some ways, putting it all together, let's talk about support. We could have done everything right in the preceding sections, but support is where the rubber hits the road in terms of what is the operational health of the system. And running Link support operations can be tough for an enterprise. What we usually see or often see is that you have a small IT staff that's often largely preoccupied with fighting voice quality or other end-user-specific fires. Those fires burn hotter when they come from execs and from others in the org. But net-net, that can often leave little time for proactive stuff. So let me talk about a different support model. A model that turns support on its head from being a primarily reactive and firefighting operation to a primarily proactive operation. How many of you have heard of Microsoft's Premier Support for Link Partners program, PSLP? Great, so a couple of you. So through PSLP, we offer a support service called Power Assurance, where we have the enterprise help desk escalate tier one end up support requests to us. And the cornerstone of that approach is being proactive about support. And let me give you an example. For a nonprofit organization that we're working with that has about 2,000 users worldwide, most of them in North America, We turned on our support service for them, the usual 800 number call and the usual contacts on both sides, getting aligned, so on 24/7 basis. Turned that on about 24 months ago. And they've been, as part of our support service, we take on the responsibility of setting PowerMon up and monitoring PowerMon alerts, so on. So one day we noticed that our support team started to get these PowerMon alerts around voice quality out of their London office. And we're seeing an NMOS of 2.78, which isn't great, points to a problem. And sure enough, when we looked at the data, there's a clear pattern of call failures on voice quality, specifically about around London. And we quickly tracked that down based on our other experience with similar alerts at other organizations to a TCP/UDP misconfiguration issue at the Edge server in London. Basically, the Edge server had gone through some patching and so on, and as a result of that, UDP ports were just not configured, and all calls started to go over TCP. The configuration changed proactively, and sure enough, the issue completely vanished at that point. Now, interestingly, all of this was done proactively. Not a single end user called help desk. Takes a lot for end users to call help desk, by the way. This is where a support team reacting on an alert or based on an alert proactively detected the issue, fixed the issue before the enterprise help desk even got involved. So that's the power of a proactive approach in general, not just support, but even deployment, pilot, and all the way upstream. We find that enterprises that stay on top of their goals, their current state, their metrics, their objectives, and are very focused around all of that, very deliberate around all of that, really tend to drive great results when it comes to global scale Link deployments. So that'd be the one takeaway I'd have for you from the session today. We've got, so I encourage you to come up to our booth. We're at booth 222. We also have some experts right here in the room if you're interested in having a chat. For instance, if I could have Mark Oxenick stand up. Mark is our VP of IT Innovation and Support and just came to us from Microsoft IT, where he ran Microsoft's global scale Link voice deployment. So ran all of the operations around it. It's been associated with Link for over the last 10 plus years at Microsoft. So great resource to chat with about Link operations. Thank you.